Today, how the need for water is driving migration. And there's renewed anger in Hong Kong as protesters face years in prison.
There is crisis at our southern border, and it is getting worse.
It's terrible. We're facing an unprecedented, unmitigated crisis on the south border.
We have a crisis at the border of drugs, of human beings being trafficked all over the world. They're coming through.
The phrase crisis at the southern border comes up time and again in coverage of the thousands of people trying to migrate from Central America and Mexico into the U.S. What also comes up are the reasons people are leaving their homes.
And of criminals and gang members coming through.
Poverty, war, crime, homicide, corruption. But one word that's rarely used in these discussions is water. For the past few weeks, The Guardian's Nina Lakhani has visited three countries in Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, to find out how the need for water and the climate emergency is forcing people to leave their homes and make a journey that has claimed thousands of lives. In this episode, you'll hear stories from each of these countries. Stories like that of Esteban, the Guatemalan farmer, who Nina came across as he was on his way to meet a people smuggler.
He waited for us, and then we sort of drove down, you know, this dirt track sort of towards his family. And I wanted to speak to his wife and his mom and stuff. And he was just becoming increasingly tense and anxious to the point that he started crying. He was like, please, please take me to the town. He's not going to wait for me. I have to meet the smuggler. Otherwise, how am I going to get out of here? What do you tell someone? He knows that it could be a disaster. He knows that he might die. His child might die. People are desperate. Their kids are starving. They do not have enough water. I mean, this is about survival. That's it. That's the bottom line.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rakeson. Today in Focus, how the fight for water is forcing people across the US border. We managed to speak to Nina from a remote farm while she was working in the region. So if you hear a cockerel, it is a cockerel. I've never been to Central America. What's it like?
So Central America is made up of seven countries. So it starts just south of Mexico at Guatemala and ends at Panama. It's sort of a thin strip of land that is flanked by the Atlantic Ocean on one side, the Pacific Ocean on the other side, and the Caribbean Sea. And so really, that's why it is one of the most, you know, vulnerable regions in the world to the climate crisis, because it is fundamentally just a large island. It's absolutely beautiful. It's really green. There's, you know, several other countries have volcanoes, beautiful beaches. It has a coral reef. It's so pretty.
So the geography of Central America makes it vulnerable to extreme and unpredictable weather. And Nina wanted to see the effects of this for herself. Her journey began in the region of Camotan in Guatemala.
Camotan is a municipality in eastern Guatemala. Camotan is in what is known as the Dry Corridor of Central America. And it's called the Dry Corridor because, relatively speaking, it rains less than the rest of the region. The people that live there are predominantly, almost exclusively, peasant farmers, what we call in Spanish campesinos. So they rely on the rain in order to grow basic crops, mainly beans and maize. And in this region, in the Dry Corridor, there's been a drought for the last 4 or 5 years. Between 50% and 90% of crops have been lost since 2016.
One of the farmers that you met was a man called Esteban. Tell me about him.
We were driving through this sort of this hilly terrain on an unpaved road. And as we were driving, we just saw this group of people busily planting seeds. It was just after sunrise and it had rained. And I just called over, and a guy called Esteban Gutierrez, a 30-year-old man, came over to talk to me. Big smile, really friendly. But the story he started to tell me about his family, his wife is 22 years old, he's 30, and they have five children aged 7 months to 9 years old. And he just started telling me about just how hard life had been the last few years, that they'd had failed harvest after failed harvest because of the drought. And he was telling me that they had two quintales of maize left, which would really, for a family of seven, was only going to last one more month. We drove a bit later to his house where he lived, you know, with his wife and kids, but also his mom, his brother, the whole extended family in these sort of adobe houses with palms as, for the roof. Very basic conditions, no running water. And I met his kids and, it was heartbreaking, all of them were malnourished, all of them. They were all so small for their age. In Guatemala, almost 50% of children are chronically malnourished. God. His wife, Miriam, breastfeeding the baby, she weighs 90 pounds. That's nothing. It's not even 7 stone. Wilson, who was the oldest child, he's 9 years old. He looked like a six-year-old. And Esteban's mom was saying to me, do you have any idea what it's like to make the kids go to sleep at 6 p.m. because there's nothing to eat, but they wake up at midnight and they're crying because they're hungry. And then they wake up and we send them to school having eaten half a tortilla because there's nothing else to eat. It doesn't matter how long you do this, it's heartbreaking. When you see kids not able to play because they're so hungry, that doesn't ever stop being heartbreaking, and it makes you angry. It makes me angry. Obviously, the current drought, which is now in its fourth year, is exacerbating the situation. But the fact that Guatemala has a worse chronic malnutrition rate than the vast majority of countries in sub-Saharan Africa, it's absolutely inexcusable and it's avoidable.
What can Esteban and his family do about this then?
The only choice that Esteban felt he had left was to try and get to the United States. If Esteban makes it and he manages to get over the border and get a job, the first $5,000 he earns, he will pay back that people smuggler. If he doesn't get over the border and he gets sent back, that, the coyote keeps the land. He was pointing out to me various neighbours who were in that situation who had mortgaged their land, essentially, to pay the coyote in order to get to the US, but had not made it across and therefore had lost their land. So the very little thing that they had, they'd lost. They now had no way of even just growing maize.
So he's surrounded by people who've tried and failed, but still this is the best option for him.
They're just out of options, And the climate crisis is exacerbating things. It's getting hotter, it's getting drier. But also the situation is that there is no irrigation, there's no running water, there's no sanitation in this, in that region. And that is a result of failed government, a government that has not cared enough to invest in these basic services. So, for example, when we were visiting Esteban and other families in that, in those communities, the water levels are so low because of the drought that the only access to water people have are streams that are still running. But there's no toilets, there's no sanitation. So actually, these streams are contaminated by dirty water. It's this vicious cycle of there's no water, there's no land, there's no sanitation. All of that generates illness and hunger. And these conditions are being absolutely, exacerbated by the climate crisis and increasing droughts and, extreme weathers.
Nina told me that government aid to regions like Camatan has been inadequate and ad hoc. Meagre rations and financial aid from social programmes reach only some of the communities. Esteban's family has never received aid. And the government also faces structural problems and problems of corruption. And that's part of the water problem in the next country that Nina visited. A few hours south from Camatan in Guatemala is San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. Right across this country, water is a particularly valuable commodity.
El Salvador is the most densely populated country in Central America, and it's a country with the lowest water reserves. one study that was done by the human rights prosecutor in El Salvador a few years ago concluded that unless radical action was taken to preserve more water, to change the way that water was being used, in 85 years, El Salvador would no longer be viable as a country because there would not be enough water.
God, 85 years really is no time at all. And one of the people that you met in El Salvador was a man called Victor Funes. Tell me about his day-to-day life.
So Victor Funes and his wife, Blanca Lopez, they live in this sort of makeshift community of 50 or so households along a disused railway, just on a sort of outskirts of the capital, San Salvador. And they have no water. They're considered to be an illegal community. So the authorities have, in the last 4 years since they got there, refused to connect them to the water mains. And so for Victor and his wife and all those people in that community, they pretty much spend all day thinking about, talking about, planning and trying to get access to water. It made me think about actually how in the UK we pretty much just talk about the weather and football or cricket if it's the summer. In El Salvador, in these communities, every conversation is about water. You know, oh, how much have you got left? When are you going to connect? How are you going to get your next water? So in the case of Victor, he walks to a public cemetery and there is a tap in a cemetery. He goes like with this big urn, this pink plastic urn, fills it up, then walks back to his house where his wife is waiting to either wash clothes or to make breakfast. Then he walks back, fills it up again, and he probably does that 20 times a day.
And are there people in Victor's community who are exploiting this desperate need for water?
As access to water gets harder and harder, that sort of, you know, generates conditions that are ripe for corruption. So those who have money or are, you know, or have linked to politicians or their gang members means that they can get access, you know. And so in the case of La Estación, where Victor and Bianca are from, there are gang members in, you know, throughout the community. So when there is a dispute about how to access water or who gets access to water or what decision the community is going to make, the omnipresence of the gangs is there. You know, it's an added extra threat.
So what, if anything, is being done to preserve water and reduce these levels of corruption?
There is a grassroots effort which includes a combination of the Catholic Church, sort of civil society, human rights groups, environmental groups, who have been pushing, you know, the government to pass a new law which recognises water as a human right, you know, that wrestles away control from corporate interests. What's happening in El Salvador is that industrialists, and when I say that, I'm mainly talking about sugarcane plantation owners, but also, you know, like the Coca-Cola bottling company, which is right in, you know, really close to this community that I visited, they get access to water. They get as much water as they need. And they also pollute water. They pollute water sources, they pollute streams, they pollute land. And there are no sanctions for this. The lobbying by different, you know, corporate groups and big business, basically, has persuaded governments until now anyway to just keep things as they are, to do nothing.
Nina left El Salvador and travelled next to the south coast of Honduras, where she found that water has a very different impact on life there. And it was in one community along this coast that she met Eric.
Eric's this young guy who has this sort of little beach restaurant right at the seafront, you know, that he has with his mum. And what they've done is just set up a little, you know, a really sort of casual little restaurant where they sell the fish of the day, the catch of the day with rice and beans. It's got a stunning view, like this golden sand. And they set up this little restaurant a couple of years ago.
What has Eric seen change?
When they set up this, you know, their little place, there was two other restaurants in between them and the ocean, and they've gone. And they've gone because of tidal surges and massive waves that have just come, just crashed away those two businesses. And that's happened across the bay.
Are these relatively new, these surges?
What locals say, it's like, you know, there's all tidal surges have always happened, but what they say in the last 10 years or so, these tidal surges and big waves and, you know, the rise in sea level is really taking away about a metre of the beach every year.
My God.
So now in between Eric's restaurant and the, you know, and the water, there's just a couple of metres of sand, whereas before there was this massive golden beach.
The climate crisis is contributing to rising sea levels, but are there other reasons that this region is experiencing an increase in these tidal surges?
That whole bay, that whole region had huge swathes of mangrove forests. And what mangroves do, they are, you know, nature's barrier, you know, for coastal regions, which protects them from, you know, from the sea, protects them from, you know, these sort of these tidal surges. And these mangrove forests have been devastated. They've been destroyed by the shrimp industry. The prawns that, you know, you might be eating today for lunch in the UK, have a look at the label. Lots of them come from Honduras and come from the Gulf of Fonseca.
And these shrimp farms, what do they look like?
I climbed up a hill, sort of just a little bit inland, and across the bay, what you see are these massive, they look like swimming pools. They're in the shape of swimming pools that have been built and have been constructed all the way across the bay, which has destroyed nature's own, you know, barrier. And it has just opened up these little beach communities to the elements, you know. And so when the waves sort of need somewhere to go, they look for openings. And that's why they go into these communities and just sort of really just eat away at the sand. And that's why they're being destroyed so fast. And the mangroves don't just act as, you know, as a barrier. They also, you know, mangroves are a nursery for fish. You know, the fishermen that Eric buys his fish off every day, they're finding less and less fish every year. It's becoming harder and harder for them to survive, which again is generating poverty. You know, it's generating the floods and the lack and the poverty are forcing people to leave these communities.
Do you get a sense that the government is trying to kind of put pressure on the industry, or to are they interested in solving the problem?
It's the government that are sanctioning the expansion and the construction of more and more shrimp farms. There's a lot of grey areas. So it's, you know, what locals told me were that politicians, local politicians, were also invested in the shrimp industry. Even when they were breaking the law, nothing really happened. You know, there were no consequences. And so the laws exist. There are laws to protect the mangrove forest and to protect the coastlines of Honduras. But these laws are not implemented. And when industry violates these laws, there's no sanctions or very few.
At the end of this trip, you know so much about this region, but did you see the problems in the area? Did you look at these, you know, the images of migrants trying to make their way to the border? Did you kind of see it in a different light?
Yeah, I think so. And I've been reporting on sort of environmental destruction, you know, for several years. And I've been reporting on forced migration for several years. And I think what it's made me realise is that the two are so interconnected. We know since 2016, like 1.2 million people from those three countries have been apprehended at the US border. 1.2 million.
Wow.
And, you know, violence absolutely is playing a role. So is extreme poverty. So is corruption. And so is impunity. But the water wars, you know, the battle for dwindling natural resources, which has been, you know, which have been exacerbated by the global climate crisis, but also just the selling off of natural resources by politicians who are more interested in making money than looking after their own people, is absolutely playing a massive role. For me, the battle for water is the major thing causing people to migrate, not just in Central America, but globally.
Did you get a sense of that at all on your trip? I mean, 1.2 million since 2016, that is a huge number. Did you kind of get a sense of any of the governments of those countries or externally kind of really making this link between climate and poverty, violence, migration, and trying to actually do something to stop it?
Those in charge, those running the country, the economic elites and the political elites, have shown no interest in wanting to change that. Because it would mean actually looking at their own wealth creation and their own, you know, and their own power. So until now, I've not seen any, you know, indication from any of the countries in the region, less still from the US government, that they're willing to think about global climate factors and water sustainability in order to try and deal with the migration crisis.
Do you know how Esteban is now, him and his son Wilson?
I don't know, and it's something I think about every day. You know, I kept in touch with Esteban. He'd been given, you know, it was just like a cheap throwaway phone, and it stopped working. So we don't know if his number changed or he lost the phone or something happened to him en route. I really don't know. But, you know, I mean, practically every week there's a tragedy you hear about, and it's, you know, someone from Guatemala who's been killed or something's happened to him en route. And, you know, I just hope every time I hear there's another sort of terrible case that it's not Esteban and his son Wilson.
Nina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In response to Nina's reporting in El Salvador, Coca-Cola said that they are committed to the sustainability and conservation of the country's resources. They said that since 2015, they have implemented a program which provides drinking water and sanitation to more than 4,000 people in local communities. Nina carried out this reporting for the Running Dry series. You can read that and more of her work at theguardian.com. Coming up, tensions are on the rise again in Hong Kong. Now, in June, protesters started taking to the streets of Hong Kong over proposed new extradition laws that many felt were a vehicle to further Beijing's influence over the territory. On Wednesday, 40 people appeared in a Hong Kong courtroom, among them a nurse, a pilot, and several teenage students, all facing up to 10 years in jail over rioting charges. With further protests planned for the weekend, The Guardian's Emma Graham Harrison looks at an increasingly tense standoff.
The head of the Chinese army in Hong Kong hadn't commented on the protests until yesterday, when at a reception celebrating the anniversary of the People's Liberation Army, he described the unrest as something which should not be tolerated. That in itself was a pretty strong statement, but the military followed up by releasing this quite extraordinary video of the People's Liberation Army Hong Kong garrison, which looks like they are preparing for war. There's a section where you see the army sort of facing off against protesters. You see a soldier shouting in Cantonese, which is the language of Hong Kong. All consequences are at your own risk. There's just been a sense, essentially, that the authorities have doubled down on their support for the police and have sort of entrenched their position. So the protests in Hong Kong have been going on for about 2 months now. They were originally sparked by an extradition bill, which sounds a little bit legal and technical, but essentially would have allowed any resident or visitor to Hong Kong to be sent to mainland China to face trial. The protesters in some ways are quite clear about what they want. They want the extradition bill killed, they want police held accountable for police brutality, they want the government to stop using rioting charges. But I think to a certain degree this has become about more than just the issues which are immediately at stake, and it's become to a certain extent a fight over the sort of soul and future of Hong Kong. What's happened in Hong Kong has been a huge setback for the government in Beijing. You've seen under Xi Jinping an increasingly assertive and autocratic China that really has had very few public setbacks. And so for Xi Jinping, a man who sort of staked his reputation, who's built his presidency around tightening his controls over China, stamping out any challenge to party authority. To be forced into this kind of U-turn in itself is humiliating. To be forced into this U-turn effectively by a show of democratic strength, by popular protests, is doubly humiliating. From the way the Chinese leadership has behaved, I doubt any compunction they would have about using force in Hong Kong would be a moral one. It would be more about the practical implications. There's obviously very strong reasons for Beijing not to send in the army, not to use force. But I think what's really worrying about the whole situation is you're seeing both sides becoming more entrenched, more radicalised. The only sort of connection, the only communication you seem to have between the Hong Kong authorities and the protesters is when they meet on the streets and you have these battles with tear gas and riot police. And I think that in itself is very, very worrying and very disturbing because, you know, as the two positions harden, it becomes more difficult to see how Hong Kong finds a peaceful way out.
Do follow the latest on the trials and the protests on our website. And you can also find out more about the extradition laws in the podcast we did with Emma from the end of June. It's called Why Aren't Hong Kong's Protesters Backing Down? That is all for today. My thanks to Emma Graham Harrison and to Nina Lacani. Today's programme was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Rosie Gillett. The sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll see you next week.